ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on Radio National.
Very suave, erudite kind of guy.
We're here to surprise, delight, and maybe enrage you from time to time. We go where our curiosity leads.
Let's talk crazy. Let's act crazy. Let's be crazy, because then the enemy doesn't know what you're thinking.
Late Night Live, 4 new shows a week on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
How are we doing? Fill in this 15-minute survey and tell us what you think of the minefield over the years. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host as we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life, or otherwise just ensure we're delivering a good customer experience. Scott, hello.
Hey, Waleed.
Do you like that one? I just riffed that as the music was playing. I thought, I think I'll do that.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I mean, one of the, can we call it an institutional orthodoxy of the last 15 years is that bad engagement is better than no engagement. Bad surveys are better than no surveys. The worst thing of all is to have no reaction to what it is that you do. Better for people to hate it rather than to leave people feeling indifferent, right?
Yes. What is it? The opposite of love isn't hate, it's indifference.
Yep.
What was that from? Sex in the City or something? Well, I don't even know how I know that line.
I don't know where it's from, but indifference is one of the worst of all affects, or lack of affects. The kind of
This is not a new thing though, right? Any publicity is good publicity. Very old saying.
Of course it is.
Sorry, dear listener, there is a reason we're talking. We've launched straight into the topic before we've set it up, but this is where we're going today, isn't it? This sort of, it's the currency, not of the service or the act or whatever itself, but of the responses, the reactions to it in various forms that it takes in our lives. And I don't know if you, I mean, I'm sure you actually agree with this, Scott. You would have to, because it's, but the ubiquity of this, I don't know how you'd slice it up in percentage terms, but I'm just going to pluck a figure out of the air. It feels like 80% of what I take in is not the original thing. It's the reaction to the original thing.
I think that's probably right. There are a number of things that are changing so that, call it the primary thing, the original content, and the reaction to that content. There are various ways that they've both been teased apart and they've also been made to become codependent upon one another. Look, can I just give you an example? We're not just talking, I think, about reaction, but about the emotions that undergird those reactions, but also the extent to which we don't just want to see the original thing, we also want to see the emotions that accompany it. So one of the things that I constantly revert to, and people are going to, I'm sure, be, you know, rolling their eyes furiously when I bring this up, you know, at the beginning of the founding of what we might call the popular press in Northern Europe, one of the ideas that undergirt the popularity, that was part of the promotion of the popular press itself, was we'll not only give you the news, we'll also give you content that'll tell you how to feel about the news. There's a particular podcast from a particular masthead that's not the ABC, but is very well known around the world. They have a particular audio service called Opinion, and the tagline at the beginning of that particular service is, "You've heard the news, here's what to make of it." This promise of, well, we're not just going to give you the facts, we're also going to give you the emotional register that accompanies the facts. We're not just going to give you the news, we're also going to give you the wherewithal to then take out into the wider world and show that you yourself are emotionally invested in the news. So this is, you know, one of the satiric, wonderfully satiric elements in Gustave Flaubert's Madame Bovary, is bound up with the figure of Monsieur Homais, who studiously, diligently reads the newspaper every morning so that he can ingest the opinion sections, so that he can commit them to memory. So he not just knows the events of the world, but also he has the proper emotional register to then inveigh against the events of the world, so he can go out into public into the cafes and the public squares and shine due to his erudition. So this idea of not just the thing, but how to react to the thing, but also how to respond to it. Soren Kierkegaard in 1846 did exactly the same thing. One of the things that the popular press does is it not only gives you the thing that you are supposed to learn, but it also then populates the inner world. It populates the domain of interiority. It gives you the opinion that you should have as the result of reading that news, as a result of encountering those stories from around the world. So it seems to me that with any popular media, there is this, let's call it a split screen, can we? Where two things are teased apart but also brought back together again. And one of the ways that I really encountered it through my two youngest boys, they used to love React videos. They loved React videos where you would see a trailer or, I mean, funnily enough, Waleed, one of the first ones that I ever watched with them was a group of kids watching Freddie Mercury's performance at Live Aid 1985.
Yeah.
And so you not just see the music, you don't just see the performance, but then you also have alongside that these young people reacting to something that they evidently had never seen before. And it's part of the pleasure then of not just seeing the thing, but also seeing the response to the thing, seeing the emotional register that flits across their faces as they themselves express a degree of wonder at the thing.
Yeah, it's probably one of the most prevalent online genres to the extent that any such thing can be said to exist in such a, I don't know, fractured and fragmented.
Not only is it there with, say, live stream gaming, where you have someone, you know, quite literally live streaming a game with a little thumbnail up at the top that has the face of the live streamer themselves, and part of the pleasure of it is, evidently, I don't derive any pleasure from it, but part of the pleasure of it is... do you want to call them performed reactions? You want to see the person reacting to what it is they're playing. But I also wonder, Waleed, I don't know if you're going to agree with this.
Mm-hmm.
And I may well be shooting myself in the foot. But the migration of audio podcasts into video form.
Yeah, yeah.
So that we don't just listen to the people, but we also want to, and again, you have the split screen. You have the guest on one side and you have the host on the other. You don't just want to hear what's being said. You also want to catch something of the emotional register that is going across their faces. You want to see the responses on their faces as they speak to one another, such that I'm often left wondering, what's the real content here? Is it what's being said? Or is it the reaction to what's being said?
Yeah, you could make the same observation about television.
Of course.
About any visual medium, really. I mean, you could make it about theatre, even though it's obviously performed in a different way. But do you know what's interesting? Just to, I think, add a layer to what you're saying. The interesting thing about those podcasts that are then put online as video is they don't work when people are well-dressed and the sets are well-constructed and so on. So in other words, the more it looks like they're not in front of cameras and that they haven't gone out of their way to do anything to put it in front of a camera, the better it works in that particular medium. And I think that goes to the heart of something that perhaps explains why it is that this has become so popular, this sort of genre, and how it is that reaction videos, reaction everything, just hits a nerve within us. And that is that it needs to be a kind of performed authenticity. So when you see someone confronted with some event in their lives, right, a flash mob or, I don't know, watching a song, listening to a song for the first time, you see them react. The whole phenomenon of Gogglebox is amazing. That show has been so successful. I think what it is that we're reacting to, whether this is accurate or not, is this sense that we're somehow seeing the bit of the human being, that experience in the human condition that cannot be masked, that there is something authentic at the heart of it, which disappears the minute you're, you know, on a fancy set wearing a nice suit or whatever and proper makeup and all that sort of stuff. So when someone watches, what did you say, Freddie Mercury's performance at Live Aid for the first time, the disbelief you are suspending is that this is in any way contrived, And sometimes it's not, by the way, but it might be. You're not engaging in that. You feel like what you're witnessing is in a moment that is drowning in authenticity and curated content and all this sort of stuff, that you're witnessing the thing that can't be curated. I think that's one dimension of this, which is why we've always loved shows like, you know, hidden camera shows or whatever. It's the real human reaction and then the casting of yourself into that circumstance. How would I have reacted and so on? And through that, there's something about the shared human experience. But the other thing that I think is going on in a lot of these, and we're not just talking about reaction videos, by the way, today, but I think the other thing that's going on in that is the legitimation of your tastes. I'm not interested in someone's, you know, delighted, spontaneous reaction to hearing a song I don't like for the first time. But I am interested when they discover the thing I've loved my whole life. One of my favourite examples is watching Americans watch Australian rules football, for example, and just be blown away by this sport. I understand national show, there'll be people who don't like Australian rules football. Just take it on board as an idea. It's a thing we have and have produced as a country that no one else has. Mm. And so if someone else discovers it and says it's amazing, there's something validating about that, right? But when this becomes a genre, then what's really interesting is you know exactly what to provide. I'll just go around finding things that seem to have a lot of fans. I'll be the person who's never discovered it before, and then I'll talk about how amazing it is and how it blew my mind and, you know, whatever. And there's an immediate fan base for that sort of content because you're valorizing this thing. I'm legitimating now your tastes or your experiences. I've come across examples online of like, obviously, you know, I'm a football fan, a round ball fan. And, you know, fans of one club doing stories about how miserable they are about the success of one of their rivals every week. It's amazing. Who's that appealing to? I'm sure it's not the fans of the club they support. It's the fans of the other club who are like, yeah, I love seeing you have to be miserable at the, you know, success of my team. The rivalry gets reinforced in that way. Something about me is being reinforced. I guess what those two things have in common, even though they're quite different, those two things have in common is that there is something about the self and the self, the identification of the self that is being reinforced in all of this, whether it be through some kind of common shared experience or whether it be through the valorization of some particularity that is associated with me.
Sure.
And so at the heart of this, I think, can be a kind of egotistical element, one way or another, or at least that's always a live danger.
Look, I don't basically disagree, but I think that maybe that particular line of argument may have run out about 12 years ago.
Why 12?
Yeah, I think we've actually moved into something subtly but significantly different. So the model of spontaneity, of spontaneous responses, what you're really talking about there is the kind of candid camera model, where someone is being caught on camera, they're responding to things, an absurd situation in real life. But then there was always that moment, and this was the moment of the shift from authenticity to inauthenticity, when the person gets told you're on candid camera, and then suddenly spontaneous actual human responses morph into face-saving, slight embarrassment. The person goes from being themselves to acting themselves.
I don't know about that, because I think even that moment is a moment of real human response.
Of course it is.
How do I respond to this revelation?
Of course. I don't disagree. I think the whole spontaneous dimension, the whole thing about spontaneity, of sincerity, I even wonder if that has simply just passed us by.
So, no, I quite agree. That's the point I'm making with the reaction videos, where I will now, instead of it being a candid camera, it's me filming myself reacting to something that I know will appeal to someone else.
That's right. And I think really the better analogy there is something more like Big Brother than it is candid camera. So at that point, you are no longer really simply being yourself. You are offering a series of responses, reactions, and emotional register as something that is communicative in and of itself. And look, I think there is a really important distinction here that needs to be made. Emotions communicate. Emotions, like facial expressions, are themselves a kind of emotional register. We use emotions to signal approval, love, disapprobation, contempt, shame. And there's a reason that contempt is most often associated with the eyes and the nose. There's something about the facial expressions themselves that convey, that discipline, that approve. There's something about the emotions that can convey warmth, that can suggest a degree of gravity, but there's also something about the emotions that can, in fact, be performed, that can be exaggerated. And I think what's been so interesting about the particular way that a form of commerce has then arisen around emotions, not as something that bears something else. So by someone's reaction, I am blown away once again by Freddie Mercury's vocal register. But the emotions themselves, it's almost as if the original thing is merely a prop, as a pretext for the ability to see the emotions that are then being displayed. But I think even further than that, and so here I'm just talking about emotions as a bearer of online commerce, emotions as something that we enter into together, emotions as something like a shared experience that we don't really have any interest being sincere or spontaneous or not. Instead, the emotions create something like a common space in which we enter. It becomes the mode through which we share things, which is another way of saying the emotional content is almost entirely agnostic about what it's responding or reacting to. The important thing, the interesting thing, is the emotions themselves. But what so worries me at this point, Waleed, I'm not saying that sort of performative emotions is itself necessarily a bad thing. When you have Greek theater and you have the chorus emoting in the course of the tragedy.
But it's acknowledged as performative.
It is acknowledged as performative, but, you know, I mean, that is, it's an elevated form of canned laughter. You are receiving instructions. There's a formative dimension to the performativity of the emotions. The problem, it seems to me, becomes when the emotions, the facial responses, we don't just want to hear someone, we want to see the way that their guest is responding to it. We don't just want to see the talking head on the television, we want to see the thumbnails of all of the people who are nodding furiously or who are emoting their particular responses. If I can put it this way, it's the rendering of all of these things so explicit to the point that emoting becomes expected.
That demanded.
Demanded precisely because of the commercial model. I think that's where something goes from being, you know, the way that a parent responds to things is going to be emotively formative for a child. The way that we watch people respond to things becomes formative for us. One of the things that I've mentioned extremely approvingly is what happens when you see a master critic respond lovingly to a work of art or write beautifully about a symphony or a concerto or an etude that they love. By seeing something that is worthy of love through the eyes of someone who loves it, I mean, there is an educational and a formative dimension to that. It's almost as if their emotions, it's not that their emotions are vicarious. We don't live off their emotions. But through their eyes, we see something as worthy of their admiration and their love. I think all of these things can be wonderful. But when there's the emotional demand, when there's the emotional requirement as something that is part of the commerce, part of the grammar of online spaces, it almost invites that degree of overtness, of emotional explicitness. And it then rids us, or maybe hampers us, from the ability to discern those emotional registers that are on the lower end, but that are nonetheless morally and communicatively significant. Like I sometimes bring up, the slight wince, the moment of confusion, the moment of, I need to sit with that and think rather than simply nod and register my wholehearted.
Yeah, but here's where I would draw a distinction between the reaction videos we're talking about on the one hand and the other example you gave of like filmed podcasts. Because I think in something like filmed podcasts, you still do get subtle reactions. It might be the lack of response or it might be the facial expression that they're not even aware that they're giving off
I think less so, Waleed. That's
really?
That's yeah.
I don't know. I feel like I see that stuff all the time.
Yeah.
Because what you're witnessing there is a conversation, and yes, it's a performed conversation. And yes, it's heightened. I mean, would you say our conversation right now is heightened?
I would hope so. But can I say that one of the things that enables that, and when we bring our guest in, one of the things that would further enable it, can you imagine how this conversation would change if there were cameras on the three of us as we're doing this? Part of the condition of possibility of entering into genuine conversation about things that matters is a certain degree of unselfconsciousness.
Yep, I agree with that.
And I think that degree of unselfconsciousness is not just obviated, I think it's eliminated by the presence of something that is trained on you to specifically pick up the emotional register that you are bringing to bear in response to what it is that you're hearing.
Yeah, okay, so that I understand. But the example of film podcast is still a lesser version of it than, say, television.
Yeah, sure.
You'd accept that?
Yeah, but I think one of the things that's happening with television is increasingly mimicking film podcasts. There was this moment, Waleed, back in 2022, David Simon and George Pelikanos, these are the geniuses behind The Wire, one of the greatest shows of all time. There was a new show that they did called We Own the City. I was giddy with excitement about it. The anticipation was almost kind of, you know, religious anticipation, devotion. Mm. Until I watched it. And all the way through the show, you not just have the narrative, but you also have these long sequences of two detectives in a room with someone who is evidently corrupt. You're hearing the evident corruption on the part of this person who's giving the testimony, who's telling the story. And then every few moments, it seemed, the camera would then switch over to the two detectives who are doing the questioning, and there would be these long shots of the two of them reacting to what it is that they were seeing, looking at one another with confusion or with grave despair. And I thought, you know what this is? This is a React video brought into HBO. And I actually think there was something kind of base about it. And it, by catering to this vernacular, by this rhythm that we've come to expect, it might even be you're not just watching a UFC fight, you're watching, not that I do, but you're watching then the moment that the camera clips over, switches over to the commentators that are calling it, who are holding one another back in response to something.
Well, you certainly see those things clipped and put online, don't
that's
you?
That's right. Then that's the point.
Where the camera is turned onto the commentary box.
Yes, precisely.
But okay, sport is an interesting example. What is the coverage of sport without the reaction shots of the crowd? Do you think that those sorts of reaction shots are, they enhance the viewing of sport, or do they detract from them?
Look, I think generally speaking, they probably enhance, because one of the things that broadcasts do is it's meant to be a kind of vicarious way of transplanting you into that.
Yeah.
But I don't think the reaction of the crowds is the right analogy here. You and I have both had experiences of overactive, of far too assertive game callers who don't let the game breathe, who don't give you a sense of the atmosphere of what's going on, but instead insert themselves.
Right, so the apt analogy is the spectacle of the commentator.
Perfect, that's
right. Or the spectacle of someone who is not part of the organic event that's unfolding, whereas
exactly
the crowd
would
normally be that. Yep. Okay, no, I understand that. There's one other genre, though, in the realm of sport that I think is really strange. And this, I think, might be a particular function of the way that football broadcasting works in the UK, where there is a blackout. So I don't know how familiar you are with this.
Yes, of course.
So at 3 p.m. on a Saturday, any football match, say in the Premier League or whatever, that takes place cannot be shown on television. It's against the law. And the idea is to, you know, encourage attendances at more local and lower level football, which it's not how it works anymore because people stream games and whatever, but that's the idea. So, but what you do get if you turn on the television at that time is a panel of people talking about the games that are going on and reacting to them. And what you also, I can't understand why anybody watches this, but it's apparently quite popular. What you also can get online is a watch-along video. So you watch with people who are watching a game, and then they will...
This is incredibly prominent, incredibly prevalent. Yeah.
Across sports. I can't imagine... Yeah. The online version, definitely, but the blackout TV version of it, only a particular set of circumstances can produce that, it seems to me. But anyway, as a TV show. This I find extraordinarily difficult. And that, I think, makes your point well, because if you're going to film yourself reacting to a soccer match, for example, well, it's not going to be worth watching you react if your reaction's muted. So you're going to have to perform something that is worthwhile watching. The question I have, Scott, and I know we're going to get to our guest, but the question I have is, do you draw a line, a conceptual line, between these sorts of reaction videos we're talking about on the one hand, and on the other hand, the online impulse, nay, imperative, to react to every bit of news with an opinion, a hot take, an emotion, or something like that? In other words, do you see a kind of unified reaction economy here, or are we in danger of grouping together quite different and disparate phenomena that have different origins in the human psyche, or perhaps even the, you know, the technological or informational landscape, or however you want to characterize it? Is this a unified phenomenon or not, I suppose, is what I'm asking.
I would suggest that emotion slash reaction is the commerce of online discourse. It's a category no less determining than the category of a verb for speech,
even,
or for sentence
irrespective
construction.
Of the kind of reaction.
Yeah. Yeah.
And irrespective of whether it's authentic or performed, or let's say spontaneous or performed.
I think we're at the point where it simply doesn't matter anymore. I think the emotion slash reaction as communicative, as a category, now occupies more or less the same role as, for instance, extreme brevity as a dominant mode of digital discourse.
So what do you do with the fact that human beings have always been creatures that monitor reactions of people? Hmm. I mean, that's always been a currency.
And there's a skill. There's a formation that goes with that. There's a pedagogy.
There's also a deformation that goes with that.
Of course there is, yes.
Okay, so, but is this online phenomenon, a currency, I think you've called it, is this a mere extension of that ancient human practice of monitoring the ongoing flow of social life and calibrating our behaviour and our understanding of the cosmos accordingly? Or do you see it as a different, like as a rupture?
I see it as a bazaar.
A bazaar?
Yeah. Let's bring in our guest.
Oh, well, no more to be said. You're listening to The Mindfield on ABC Radio National. Well, they darlies, my name's Scott Stevens, is my co-host, and on Scott's orders, let's bring it in.
our guest is eminent indeed. Nicholas Carah is director of the Center for Digital Cultures and Societies, and he's professor in the School of Communication and the Arts at the University of Queensland. Nicholas, welcome to The Mindfield.
Hey, great to be here. So I get to do my reaction video.
Yes,
to Scott.
Yes.
Well, you won't believe what Scott and Wally said. Here's what I kind of find myself thinking about, and it's like about media itself. This philosopher of effect who about 15 years ago says there's this shift going on in the function of media from being a kind of primarily ideological, representative, narrating kind of mechanism to being a modulator of effect. And so, you know, what media is doing as kind of technologies and institutions that shape our everyday lives is this site for capturing, managing, turning into data our reactions, and then subsequently managing their continuing circulation in a kind of attention economy. And if you start to think about, like, that's what media is doing, then you can start to see why reaction becomes this kind of logic of constant circulation, because what the media need to do is prompt reaction in order to translate that into data, in order to translate that into more attention and keep that cycle going and going and going. And so I think if that's like the underlying logic, then what you see proliferate around that is all of these forms of media practice and genre and rituals that become primarily about reaction. And I think, you know, effectively or socially, what's going on for us as makers and consumers of media is that we're over the last decade or so learning to inhabit a media system that we know is constantly reacting to us. And so we're reflecting that, I think, sometimes savvy, canny knowledge back out at our social world, that we get that the media is no longer just this sort of like neutral channel through which ideas flow. It's this thing we're in a dynamic, reactive relationship with. And so our subjectivities are kind of organized around this reactivity, both as practices we do with each other, but as a sensibility that everything we do is getting translated into data, and this machine around us kind of manages its reaction to us, or manages reactively how visible we're going to be to others, or, you know, and on I could go.
In other words, consumption has become itself a form of agency. Reaction is one of the ways that we impose a degree of ourselves upon what would seem to be the immovable, irresistible flow of things.
Right. And also a knowledge that reaction is inevitable. Like if you're watching television, your reactions are confined to your lounge room. But if you're on your smartphone or you're moving around any kind of digital media platform, your reactions are always visible to the media system itself. And so it's like reaction looms everywhere as kind of fundamental to the relationships that make up a media culture now, and like life in a mediated society like ours. You know, like there's like these subtle social facts that kind of seep into our sense of ourselves, and I think this is one of them.
Would another way of putting this be reaction follows from surveillance?
Yeah, like I think surveillance is part of the story here because, you know, we used to think about surveillance when we first started talking about the surveillance society and the surveillance logics of digital media. It was like, well, you know, now media collect information about you so that they can tailor, you know, what ads you see or what videos get recommended to you. But now that logic has kind of spilled out in a much more dynamic sense. So, you know, for example, this sense that the reactivity of the media system extends beyond its knowledge of me, but it's the way it positions me in a larger social puzzle. So, you know, like if you listen to any young person describe their FYP on TikTok, their For You page, they have a sense that this thing knows not just about them, but like where they fit in the social whole, like who they're proximate to. And it's responding to all of these kind of subtle shifts in their mood, their affect, their interests, their proximity with others, you know. So there's this subtle sense that media itself is this constantly reacting, tuning, shifting sort of a machine. And like, I think that begins with surveillance. Like you need to be able to translate reality into data to make that work. But it's no longer as kind of linear, I think, as many of our earlier accounts of the surveillance society were.
Okay, I've got a question for the two of you then. I don't want to generalize too much in saying this, but I realize that there's going to come with it a degree of generalization. I also am aware that there may even be a suggestion of kind of civilizational decline, which I actually don't intend here, but let me have a crack anyway. One of the ways that emotions and the way we communicate our emotions, one of the registers that we use to indicate their maturity, their development, and so on, is our ability to regulate our emotional responses or our reactions to certain things in proportion to the extent to which they are, what we are reacting to is important to us. This is one of the ways that we try to register meaning or our attachment to things. If we respond strongly to something, if we use, say, the uppermost portion of the emotional register, that suggests a degree of care, a degree of concern, a degree of attachment. So, for instance, if you watched me respond to a Boston Celtics game, I'm very glad no one is around me when I'm watching this. So that expresses a degree of my care, of my attachment to this team. Nicholas, you were talking before about, you know, we're always kind of imposing ourselves upon the digital world. It would seem to be one of the ways that we do impose ourselves is by means of that reaction achieving a certain degree of volume, but also about a dispersed number of things. So heightened responses to a wider array of things that under other circumstances might not concern us as deeply as we purport them to, and mightn't elicit the reaction that is as all caps or whatever as it would seem to. I guess my question is almost a kind of formative one. Are these online digital habits, is this a particular form of reactive currency, is this a way or could it be having an effect of taking the formative dimension of our ability to both regulate but also properly judge how to respond to certain things? Is it kind of taking the roof off and dropping the floor out of that particular emotional register?
Well, I think it's like, okay, you said civilizational decline, so let's go there.
Okay. I don't think it's the end of civilization, but I do think it's more important than maybe we give it credit.
But I guess, like, okay, well, let's try and think of why are we worried about this moment? All right, let's go back to the mass society and say, well, what were media doing? And how were media kind of really important to teaching a certain set of emotional registers and capabilities that were kind of acceptable? And you can look at, you know, the novel in the 19th century as like learning a certain kind of subjectivity and its emotional registers for the mass society. You can look at the newspaper and train commuting and how it helped us, you know, mediate our relationships with strangers as we moved about public spaces. And the mass media comes into being and narrates a particular way of thinking about the way you ought to think about being in a mass society. And then that all like shifts dramatically. And we feel it as like, if not a decline, then some kind of significant rupture. And what comes to mind a little bit is this essay that kind of went viral a few years ago by an English prof in the US saying like, my undergrads, they just don't read novels, but I don't think they can read novels. 20 years ago, they could read 10 novels in a semester. Then it was 5, then it was 2. Now they're struggling to read 1. And I think, you know, the interesting little kernel in the essay was like, it's not that they don't know how to pay attention. It's that they've learned that there's another kind of economy of attention and the novel's not it, you know? And what they've learned is that they need to be able to absorb, make rapid judgments about the kind of continuous circulation of ideas and responses and reactions. They've learned a kind of mode attuned to the sorts of industries and economies and cultures they're going to find themselves living and working.
Whereas what a novel requires is that you tarry with something.
Right.
You linger with the interiority of other characters. That was an essay in The Atlantic. I thought it was incredibly. Yeah. We'll include a link on the webpage. But I think what's interesting there is, in some ways, this actually demonstrates my point. Mm. Because of the demand to react, because of the expectation to respond, the idea that one could simply sit with something that I don't know quite what to think about yet, or something that is so far out of the realm of what I had been expecting that I haven't quite got my arms around the parameters to be able to make sense of it. I guess it's the expectation of emotion and what that does to the capacity for interiority, as Kierkegaard would put it. That's, I think, where my concern is.
I think Nicholas has kind of, in a very different way, said what my instincts were, which is, this is really epiphenomenal. I think we agree on that. But it might actually be the end of civilization because, so actually, several dots get joined here. If this is currency, if reaction is currency, and if that's the new sociology we're creating, or perhaps we'll call it an economy that we're creating, then not reacting becomes intolerable. It becomes a form of impoverishment of whatever kind. So we then have to join in the chorus of reaction. I call it a chorus because I think that's kind of what it is. What we end up with is a series of responses that become orthodox in a particular way quite quickly. If you want to be part of this tribe, you react this way. If you want to be part of that tribe, you react that way.
They can also influence. It can also sort of bring a certain degree of collective agency to bear.
Say more about that.
A Greek chorus is not incidental to a play. It inflects its movement.
Right,
it,
I see what you mean.
It deepens.
So it doesn't just react, it acts.
Yes, that's right.
Yes, okay, so I understand that, okay. But this thing happens with rapid-fire reaction to things, and here I'm thinking more of politics, news, that sort of thing, but you could apply it to aesthetic judgments. A new album gets released, a film, or whatever, where the prevailing winds sweep through so rapidly that any kind of more reflective response actually just becomes impossible to either form or express. If you manage to find shelter from the winds, then you might be able to form it, but your reaction. But then by the time you react, or respond is perhaps a better word, then no one cares anymore. It's all over. When you multiply that by, you know, millions of iterations, well, I think it seems to me the only thing you can get are poor responses. And that becomes a genuinely societal phenomenon. It becomes, if you like, civilizational. Because what disappears is not merely the impulse to respond in a more considered way or to tarry with something, I think, as you put it, Scott. The benefits of that tarrying disappear from society generally. until some perhaps some crisis emerges or something that forces us to think in a more radical, and by which I mean going back to the root sort of way about things. So isn't that the end of civilization?
Well, I think the question I think it leads me toward is like, okay, if you start organizing social life like this, then does it make you better or worse at solving problems? Does it make you better or worse at creating, you know, new things, new ways of life, new ideas? And like, that's the question that faces any society that just fundamentally transforms the techniques and technologies of organizing social life. It's like, did we come up with a good way of solving problems and organizing social life, or are we creating kind of just chaotic problems?
Oh, look, I take that point, and I think it's important, but I would like to go deeper than merely problem solving. There is more to the human condition and more to human purpose than problem solving, surely.
Okay, so let me say, this mode, what is it good at in terms of, or what kind of aspects human expression, sociality does it enable? And I think it enables us to do things that are very associative, probabilistic, pattern-based, vibey, flowing. And you see this a lot in our social media cultures where you're getting these aesthetic modes that are very interesting. They're very associative, and they're based on people's capacity to take things and react and relate them, you know, in unexpected ways.
So memification might be an example.
Yeah, example, right? But then this mode is not good at the sorts of contemplation, reflection, tarrying, et cetera, that you talk about. So it's like we've dramatically shifted the weighting, if you like, toward the modes of expression, the modes of creativity that we value in this sort of a system. And it reflects, interestingly, I guess I would say, the things that very large-scale automated models are good at. Do you know? So we're kind of reorienting those human capacities that we value toward the ones that kind of align with the things that large language models, AI, et cetera, are good at, because they are probabilistic associative machines.
This is The Mindfield on ABC Radio National. Waleed Ali's my name. Scott Stevens, my co-host. The voice you just heard belongs to Nicholas Carra, who's director of the Centre for Digital Cultures and Societies at the University of Queensland.
All right. So, lest I come across as too grumpy, why is it that we're talking about this? I think the extent to which emotions communicate, I think the extent to which emotions can be shared, can be participated in, the extent to which they form a kind of bond, a mode of connection that isn't overt, that isn't intellectual, that isn't thought through. I think that dimension of human life is unbelievably important. You referred to it before as vibey. I would never in my wildest dreams say a word like that outside of this setting. I think that can be incredibly important. We don't know exactly why it is we're connecting in this shared space, but we simply are. I think those, the communicative dimensions, the interrelational dimensions of the emotional life is unbelievably important. I also think the face is morally significant beyond words. The ability to see, to recognize depth behind a face, to be able to read expressions, not just words. I think all of these things are unbelievably important for the way that we are together, for the way that we can understand how someone else might be feeling in a particular way. I think it's important for the way that we modulate and modify what we say to respond to those very ever so slightly conveyed cues that I'm uncomfortable, I disagree, I think I want to say something, I need to think about that further, you've trespassed, you've hurt me. All of those things are incredibly important. I worry that when they are commercialized and when they are turned then into a form of expectation, as Waleed was putting it before, that so many of the things that make those communicative dimensions of the emotions, the ability to read one another's faces, so many of those things that are rightly precious almost become banal. The subtleties get worn off, and the extent to which it can in fact be a very, very good thing to simply join in an emotional flow with a social phenomenon. that many of the goods that that brings along with it can in fact be undermined by an insufficient reflectiveness on what it is that makes these registers as important as they are.
I agree. But how to think about it in terms of the world we inevitably find ourselves, you know, kind of living in and trying to navigate and make sense of. And I guess what I'm trying not to fall into is a separation here between good forms of face-to-face, material, embodied communication, socialization, you know, communion with each other, and bad forms of
merely
digitally mediated life. And so what I would find interesting then, and this is kind of come back to this idea of problem solving, is not problem solving at the level of civilizations, but problem solving, making do, adapting at the level of every day. And so how do we then learn ourselves and learn to teach each other and our kids and our parents and the people in our life, you know, modes of communication in a digital society that are kind of emotionally resonant and I want to say like non-depleting. Mm. Like why do I think we're all animated about this? Because we feel kind of worn out by the emotional intensity of the forms of media and culture that we're immersed in every day. And I guess then what I'd be interested in is those practices that seem to be trying to respond to that. Like I was sort of thinking about the lie flat movement in China that's then kind of taken off with Gen Z in the West, which is like a refusal to engage in this emotionally reactive economy, to kind of zone out or vibe out of it.
Yeah,
altogether.
But itself a reaction.
Right, yeah.
And in a weird way, a spectacle.
In a weird way, a spectacle, but a kind of, you know, like an effort to try and imagine other modes of emotional intensity or practice that don't fall into, I think, here's the despondent part of it, that don't fall into the trap of imagining that there's some possible outside of this kind of algorithmic emotional economy that we're all now tethered to.
I think there are outside, maybe not. There are corners that are not so buffeted, though.
Right, and it's like an effort to try to find those corners and protect them or to create spaces in them. Do you know, like what I was... Here's an example I'm kind of thinking about is the difference between reaction and dwelling in the both cultures and the business models of digital platforms, where the reaction economy matters in a period where, say, social media needs much more codified forms of data like likes and comments and shares, because the algorithmic models are just not as good yet as they are now. And then the killer intervention of say, Douyin and then TikTok was an algorithmic feed that responded more to the way we dwelled with content than how we reacted to it. And I think then that gets reflected in some of our practices where it's less about an intensity of reaction and more about how we communicate to others what we're dwelling with by the way we build, say, carousels or photo dumps or the way we share things in a particular kind of sequence that tries to evoke a different sort of mood or feeling that might be softer or less interventionist or something like that. You know, so I'm thinking of like parts of TikTok and Instagram where people share things like carousels of really long dead mole exploration videos or sequences of images of 1990s primary school classrooms. And these are not insignificant kind of social media cultures that I think say something about us going, here's some ways of just like changing the intensity of these flows and their kind of emotional character.
But do you think it's strange, though, that that's the solution rather than, I don't know, not watching videos for a bit?
I mean, maybe despondent is not the right word, but it's strange, yeah, in the sense that, like, it's I can't get away from this reactive economy, so I'm just going to find ways of retuning my reactions and then hopefully the way it reacts to me. Because if I start dwelling like this or posting like this, then the way it kind of tunes toward me in terms of what it starts to send me, the emotional character of that will start to change as well. And so people sort of talk a lot about how I've really trained my algorithm, like it's really in tune with me. And I think some people want to go down a full-on intense emotional reaction kind of thing, but others are saying like, I've just tuned it to be a softer, greener, gentler presence in my life. And I think that's the kind of subjectivity that's emerging the last post-2020, post the something like TikTok's For You page becoming the kind of predominant algorithmic mode in our culture?
So I see that, and I can see what there is to celebrate in it. I still just think it's a very strange place to go for your solution.
In the 1990s, that's what we all have reacted straight away and said, nah, that's like just selling out, man. Like,
well, no, I don't even mean selling. I mean, sure, yeah, you could use it. But I just think what it seems to say is, well, I've got to watch something.
Yes.
I mean, I've got to scroll something. Like, that's just the given. Well, why is that the givenness of it? I don't know. And in the long run, I'm not sure it redeems us from the civilizational collapse that we are not talking about, because you're not going to seek refuge from the machine in the machine. Eventually that machine, like, especially once you add things like profit motive and whatever, if what you're trying to do is train the algorithm in a way that's going to become less profitable, it'll figure out a way to turn you back in a profitable direction.
And then, okay, so how much weight do you put in, you know, I guess I'm really thinking about Gen Z and younger kind of digital media users here. Just, I guess they're a group trying to figure it out. You know, how much do you put in there that they don't post much and that a not insignificant number of them are buying dumb phones?
That strikes me as a far more meaningful intervention.
Right. And like, how much in these everyday practices do we, you don't want to overweight them. It's not like some consequential number of young people are now throwing the smartphone away for a dumb phone, and to the point that like Meta's worried about their profits or something.
Yeah,
do you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But what can we learn from these sorts of practices about what they might say about shifts in our culture? That the kind of reaction economy that got created in the 2010s, you know, maybe it isn't as durable and as stable as we thought in both everyday life and at the level of like what it did to our civilizational politics.
Yeah, okay. So that's a very tempting conclusion.
Right.
I'm more encouraged to that conclusion by the dumb phone example, though, than I am by the alternative videos.
Well, the alternative videos is interesting to me because it's more widespread and it's an acknowledgement that, like, even though I find myself here, I understand its logic. I'm trying to muck around with its logic. I'm trying to find another tune. Like, it's a suggestion of a broader cultural acknowledgement or assessment of what's going on.
I understand that. It just strikes, the analogy I would use is it just seems to be looking for a pure version of a narcotic.
I don't think there's anything pure about it. I mean, what it is, you know.
Well, no, I just mean higher quality drugs.
No, sure, sure. But any culture that is given over to a degree of, let's call it decadence, as a sort of shorthand, will also generate its own form of asceticism.
Right.
And one step in from that form of asceticism will be a kind of chastened version of that which fits more precisely within the decadent culture. I mean, here I think of the novels of someone like Michel Houellebecq that are horribly sort of decadent, undisciplined, loathsome in many respects, but the process of reading his novels is to feel along the edges of a particular cultural moment. To that extent, there is something almost virtuous in his very immoral lawlessness. I'm not saying precisely the same thing, but to push against an algorithm to that extent, to offer up a particular form of content that actually has its own kind of aesthetic beauty, even within its own commitment to a certain aesthetic practice, acidic practice.
Right.
There is something in that about identifying the limits of where something can go.
That's what I find these aspects of social media production are interesting for exactly these reasons. They're like showing us an important kind of aesthetic practice that we've always sort of had in the industrialized society of how to play, in a sense, with the master's tools, how to find modes of expression in them that produce a broader subjective aesthetic kind of awareness of our situation, do you know, that maybe is the precursor to other things, but at least, you know, at a minimum points out that we're not like mindless dupes to this reaction economy whose brain, you know, like we're just fully plugged into the matrix. And it's not that sort of a culture we live in. We live in one where our sense that something is unstable, exhausting, unlikable about this situation is sort of seeped into our souls, and we're trying to find other ways of saying, did you notice this? You know,
I think
that
much I think is certainly true. Yeah.
Nicholas, that's all we have time for. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Nicholas Kara, director of the Center for Digital Cultures and Societies and professor in the School of Communication and the Arts at the University of Queensland. That's it for this week's episode of The Mindfield. You can catch us again next week on ABC Radio National or anytime on ABC Listen.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.